misunderstanding all of this, people miss the point and say the New Testament actually throws out the law. Well, our Greek friend goes on to say, one fact I might stress is that students of the Old Testament do not necessarily need to have the New Testament to know Yahweh, because under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, they can draw from the Old Testament and other Jewish sources to come to know the fulfillment of Scripture the same way that the writers of the New Testament did, but the reverse is not true. So Yahweh gives us the foundation of understanding in the Old Testament. And if you understand that, you have the fundamentals of understanding Yahweh. What he's saying is what we have found to be the case as well. The New Testament builds on the Old Testament. It does not replace the Old Testament. But it goes a step further by fulfilling all those prophecies that were mentioned in the Old Testament and showing that Yahshua was the Messiah prophesied to come. But to just take the New Testament without grounding in the Old Testament is to only get part of the message of the Bible. It's like the guy who reads five chapters of a 20-chapter book and says he understands what the book is all about. But what I found especially intriguing is this Greek man's comments on the interplay and sometimes the incompatibility between the Hebrew and the Greek languages from which we get our English translations of the Bible. And because these languages and the two cultures are fundamentally unlike each other, we've got problems when it comes to translations that arise especially in the New Testament. And that's what I want to focus on today. Take one example. He says Hebrew is a pictorial, realistic language and does not have the concept of past, present, and future, but has a verb construction called the wa conversive. He quotes from a book called Contemporary Hebrew. Quote, some of the outstanding features of biblical Hebrew is the use of the wa conversive with verbs. Now, this is a little technical, and you may not understand it. I don't know if I understand it fully. But he says, when the conjunction and, which is the wa, remember we went through the wa consecutive, when every sentence begins with and. You see that in the Old Testament? You see it in the New Testament, showing that the New Testament is based in a Hebraic language, because the Greek doesn't do that. That's not part of the Greek way of doing things. Well, anyway, he says, when you add this wa conversive, when it's prefixed to the past perfect tense, it changes its meaning to future. Future imperfect. When the wa is prefixed to the future imperfect, it changes its meaning to the past perfect. What does it mean? He says by doing this, the Hebrew language conveys that Yahweh spoke everything in the beginning, and it is neither completed. It is either completed or being completed. He said, Greek thought does just the opposite. So how does the Greek language handle this peculiarity of the Hebrew language when translating? Well, it's interesting because maybe if in your studies you've heard people talk about the aorist tense in the Greek. Aorist meaning, he says, non-defined. He said in seminaries they'll teach you that it means past tense. He says, but that's not so. It derives its tense from Hebrew thought. See, it's undefined. It switches from one tense to the other. That's fascinating. Why would it use all of that if it's not defining a Hebrew original, a Hebrew text? The aorist tense comes from the past, and it is current in the present, and in the future it will still be current. He says, this first problem of tenses was solved in the Greek New Testament by writing most of the Hebrew in the aorist tense, thereby retaining its Hebrew thought. The second problem was the fact that Hebrew is a pictorial, more or less an artistic type language. It's got all sorts of metaphors and similes and word pictures and everything like that. When you read the Psalms, you see it. And that's why it's such a living book, because it describes things in such vivid, real terms, and makes it just a beautiful rendition of thought. Whereas Greek is not that way. Imagine a math-oriented mind, a math-oriented professor, let's say, trying to deal with a book written in flowery language. We've got a problem, don't we? It drives him nuts. He doesn't know whether to accept that literally or is it figurative, because his mind, everything is literal. He takes it literally. And when he reads the something in beautiful, ornate language like the Hebrew, he doesn't know. He doesn't know what to do. And it's led to many translation difficulties and even wrong translation in the New Testament. He's trained to analyze everything literally in precise measurements with everything at face value. And when he encounters metaphors and parables, he's unsure of what it really means, whether to take that at face value. For instance, let's look at John chapter 3. Remember when Yahshua was talking, I believe it was Nicodemus, he says, want to know about salvation. And he discusses it with him. And he says, there was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. Same came to Yahshua by night and said unto him, Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from Elohim, for no man can do these miracles that you do except Elohim be with him. Just a sidelight. When the New Testament writers wrote, their books were contemporary with people who had seen all of this. And that's one of the reasons we can prove that the New Testament is accurate. Because when you talk and write about somebody you know, somebody who lived through it, you can't pull a bull over his eyes, you know? You can't do it. He knows better. So here he is talking to a man named Nicodemus. And Yahshua said unto him, Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom. Unto a literal-minded man, he has no idea what he meant. So Nicodemus is that way. He said, how can a man be born when he's old? Can he enter the second time into his mother's womb? Yahshua said, Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a man be born of water and of the Spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of Elohim. He had to explain what he meant by that. Because this man, like so many, are illiteral-minded that he couldn't understand what Yahshua was really saying. And that's the problem with the Greek. Because the Greek is not a language that likes to deal in stuff like that. What is the Ruach HaKodesh? Is it a literal person, as most people believe? Or is it the extension of Yahweh's power and energy and mind? When the Bible talks about pouring out the Spirit, what does it mean on all flesh? When Levi paid tithes, remember, before his birth, which you read about in Hebrews 7:10, what was he talking about? Through Abraham. When the seed of the woman bruises Satan's head and in turn bruises the seed's heel, what does that mean? Some of the biggest errors in talking or taking what is figurative and making it literal is found in the New Testament. This is the issue we face particularly when we go from Hebrew concepts and terminology to a Greek language. And then imagine taking it beyond that into English. It's like a puzzle on top of a puzzle on top of a puzzle. No wonder there's never any end to translations, because everyone's trying to get it more exact. As we learn, as we study, as we, you know, archaeology, as knowledge increases about the Middle East and the ancient languages and so forth, and you know, all of this, they can get a purer understanding of what the book really said. And this is the issue. It doesn't matter if you don't believe that the New Testament was originally written in Hebrew. The fact is, the New Testament is still couched in Hebraic expressions, Hebraic idioms and metaphors of Hebrew, and even Hebrew language structure, which does belie its Hebrew roots. These are not Greek phenomena. They do not originate in Greek. But to understand just a snippet of what we're talking about, let's look at an idiom. Idioms are unique because they're expressions in a language that you can't translate into another language. It doesn't mean anything to somebody else. For instance, we say, a tempest in a teacup. That's an idiom. I have other fish to fry. When pigs fly. He's a party pooper. You're pulling my leg. We understand what each of those mean, clearly to us. Go to a foreigner and try to explain that to him. He's going to take it literally. What do you mean, pigs fly? What is it, you know? If you don't quite grasp it, let's go in reverse. And here's a foreigner giving you an idiom, like in Spanish. I'm not Jose, I can't read it in Spanish, but the translation is, I asked if the butter is grease. What does that mean to us? I don't know. It means, in a Spanish idiom, I didn't beat around the bush. Well, we're using an idiom in English to explain an idiom in Spanish, and then we understand it. To remain like the one who whistled on a hill. In Spanish, that's an idiom. In English, it means to be left holding the bag, which is another idiom explained in a Spanish idiom. In German, you might say, weder Hand noch Fuß haben, which means to have neither hand nor foot. What does that mean to us? It makes no sense at all. And that's what it means, to make no sense at all. Interesting. Es wird nicht so heiß gegessen, wie es gekocht wird. In German, that means nothing is eaten as eagerly as it is cooked. In English, what it really means is nothing is ever as bad as it seems. These are idioms. Imagine now going from one language to another, trying to bring those thoughts into a Greek language, if they're supposed an idiom original. And then try to explain it to an English reader. Hebrew idioms are just one problem you have in the New Testament with a Greek translation of what the Hebrew original said. Now go to a mathematician trying to analyze some abstract painting filled with hidden meaning and metaphor. You know, that always drives me nuts. Some guy takes some slaps of paint, you know, throws it on a canvas, lets it drip all over and throws another and then takes a blower, blows it all over. And this is supposed to be art with some hidden meaning. You know, it's crazy. But that's the way a scientist would look at that. A literal, you know, math-minded type person would be a Greek looking at a Hebrew painting like that and you know, trying to make sense of it all. No wonder we have so many translation problems and errors. We're going from Hebrew to Greek to English. In some cases, same thing in the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament, and in the Latin Vulgate. Now you've got four languages you're dealing with, perhaps. The Hebrew and the Greek themselves are quite dissimilar, not to mention the vast differences between Greek and Hebrew culture and understanding the social interaction at the time, what it all means. As Yahshua's disciples wrote down what he said, it was in Hebrew with pure Hebrew thought, the language of the Old Testament. Because the New Testament is Greek, written to convey Hebrew ideas, we can't stop at the Greek in trying to understand it. We got to go back into the Hebrew. We must take it in the Hebrew context. Until we go back to the benchmark, the Hebrew, we don't really understand as it was intended. We're not going to get the complete understanding. Now we have another problem. We don't have the Hebrew in the New Testament. Maybe a few. Maybe we've got Matthew, Revelation, a couple of other books. Maybe Hebrews itself. That are old enough that they, you know, are basically true to the original Hebrew. The rest are back formations going back from, you know, a Greek and translating back into the Hebrew. And or sometimes Aramaic. Now there are, like the Peshitta and so forth, there are Aramaic, which are not as old as the Hebrew we have in the Old Testament, but they do go back, you know, a few hundred years after the New Testament. So here we have that issue too. Until we go back to the original, we really have a problem. Yahweh gave us his inspired scriptures in the language he selected to communicate them. His word and his will. And in our translations, we've created lots of confusion. What's wrong with modern translations? We all use them, we all look at them, we all refer to them. Well, first, we have to say that no translation is inspired. They're all works of men. They're all an attempt to understand what the original meant. You have different ways of doing that. You have a literal translation, word for word. Then you have an equivalent, you know, dynamic equivalent. What was the writer actually trying to say? You have different ways you can translate. The Old Testament has been faithfully preserved by the Jews in what is known as the Masoretic text. There are fewer problems in the Old Testament because they were so careful about doing that. Have you ever seen the Masoretic text? You have a companion Bible, there it is. You see the three columns there in Hebrew? Notice the little stuff between the columns along the bottom, along the side, along the top. Those are all notes that the Masoretes wrote in there, the scribes wrote in there, to help explain their translation and how they're doing it, and maybe some issues in it. You know, they knew that that wasn't inspired writing. It was their own. But to help the reader, they stuck those in there. Now, Bullinger says when the King James translators used the Hebrew, they didn't pay attention to those notes, and they lost a lot of understanding there because they just ignored those things. You know, if an editor is going to edit something and write notes about how he's doing it, it's probably pretty valuable to know, you know, what he's doing. It would really help. Especially if he's going to explain something that may be a little difficult to explain. Anyway, the Old Testament has been preserved by the Jews. But we come to the New Testament, we have a different story. Most modern translations from the Revised Standard to the New International use as their source for the New Testament a Greek based upon the text of the Codex Vaticanus and Codex Sinaiticus of the 4th century, also known as the Alexandrian text. It originated in Egypt, so now we're going into another language influence, the Egyptian, which has been massaged by the higher critics down through the ages. These manuscripts represent less than 5% of known Greek Bible manuscripts, but they're supposedly more authentic because they're old, according to some authorities. J.P. Green, have you ever seen his interlinear Greek English New Testament? He says, quote, "The marketplace is being glutted with new books which are being presented as versions of the Bible. Each one claims to be the very word of Yahweh." I'm going to use the right terms. "Yet there are literally thousands of differences between them. They all leave out dozens of references to the deity of Yahshua, and they add words which tend to question his virgin birth, his substitutionary, fully satisfying atonement," he says. This is due to their decision to depend upon the Alexandrian, the Egyptian, text base instead of that body of Yahweh's words which has been universally received and believed in for 19 centuries, the received text, which he likes to use. These new versions, like the NIV, the New Jerusalem Bible, and others, are not only marked by additions, but also by subtractions, since some 4 whole pages of words, phrases, sentences, and verses have been omitted by these new versions. And these are words attested to by Yahweh's, as Yahweh's words, by overwhelming evidence contained in all the Greek manuscripts. So what we have are problems that arise every time someone wants to create a supposedly more accurate version. And that's what all we can do is try to create the best possible one. But there's a lot of obstacles, as we're pointing out. The King James was published in 1611, which we all know. Before that, Latin was the only scholarly language in Europe. The Latin Vulgate translation, Jerome's, was based upon, many scholars say, a corrupt Alexandrian text as the official text of the powerful Roman Catholic Church. Protestant translators sometimes didn't have access to the received Greek official text, and being familiar with the Vulgate, they sometimes put words into their translations based upon the Latin, which were never there in the Greek. So here we go. We go from Hebrew to Greek, sometimes Latin in there, side roads into Latin, and then to English. I want to look at some of the translating errors that have crept in. I hope that this should prove beneficial to each of us. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 10, just to show, and some of us have grappled with some of these things, because they were not correctly translated or rendered in our English Bible, according to the original, or as close as we can get to the original. Genesis chapter 10 and verse 9. Speaking of Nimrod, he was a mighty hunter, King James says, before Yahweh. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter, before Yahweh. It should read, a mighty hunter in opposition to Yahweh. The word before is not correct. It gives us the impression that this was a good guy. He was a mighty hunter before Yahweh. You know, he was a glorious guy. No, he was in opposition to Yahweh. That's one of the problems. Other translations will fix that. Let's look at Leviticus 16. I'm going to go through a number of these. Leviticus 16, verse 8. We all know what a scapegoat is. You want to blame somebody, you blame a scapegoat. Get the monkey off your back. Another idiom, by the way. But anyway, Hebrews 16:8, "And Aaron shall cast lots upon the two goats, one for the for Yahweh and the other lot for the scapegoat. The scapegoat. The Hebrew is Azazel, which means one removed or separated. The Azazel goat, I believe, represented the evil one, who is not a scapegoat. He's guilty. He is guilty of sin, as they say. And but you see, when you go from that to a scapegoat, it lessens the guilt, and it really perverts the text. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 24. I took out there are so many of these, but I've took the ones that I think are significant and really have a impact behind them. 24:1, when a man has taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes, because he has found some uncleanness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorcement and give it to her in her hand and send her out of his house. The term "then let him" should be "and he," as Yahshua explained in Matthew 19. Moses did not command divorcement. He suffered it. He allowed it because of the hardness of their heart. But you would think, by reading the King James here, that he's supposed to do that. That's not true. Okay, Malachi, the last one in the Old Testament I want to look at. We're going to have a lot of fun in the New Testament, as you can imagine. Malachi chapter 4. Just a few little nuances can make a big difference in our understanding and in our teachings too, and what we believe. Malachi 4 verse 6, "And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse." That should read, "Lest I come and smite the earth with utter destruction." Curse is not strong enough here. It's the same word you find in Zechariah 14 verse 11. If you want to go back there, you can look at that one. Same idea. "And the men shall dwell in it, and there shall be no more utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited." Utter destruction. Pretty ominous, isn't it? We hear about the security chief of the United States saying, getting on a conference call to every state in the country, saying there's going to be an attack sometime. It's going to try to disrupt possibly the election this fall. It becomes pretty ominous. I don't know if you saw in the news, just a thought about the wall they're building over there in Jerusalem. I think it's a quarter finished. The big concrete barriers they're putting there between them and the Palestinians. Well, the UN just decided that they shouldn't do that. That's not allowed. And, you know, go ahead and just keep getting the bus bombs and everything else, because that's going against the rights of the Palestinians to put a wall in there. Utter destruction. We know that this earth is going to rock and reel pretty soon because of what man's going to do and the wars that are coming. And that's what should have been the term used in Deuteronomy 24:1. I'm sorry, Malachi 4:6. Zechariah 14:11. Okay, let's go to Matthew chapter 5 and verse 48. Here we have, I remember a man one time came to me and said, this is not possible. Matthew 5:48 is not possible. It's not possible for a man to be perfect. It says, "Be therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect." And being rather unfamiliar with that verse, I scratched my head and said, "Yeah, you're right. That doesn't make a lot of sense," until I looked it up. And what it means is, become therefore perfect. Strive for perfection. Work toward that goal. Become perfect. And that's really what it means. The Aramaic says perfect. And here again, we can go to and more ancient language, because we have some of those texts in the book of Matthew. In other words, the perfect means become whole, sincere in heart. That's what our goal is. Whether we meet perfection, that's something to be seen. But we can strive for it. Matthew 28:1, another one. This one bothers people when they try to figure out the Passover. In the end of the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first of the week, came Mary Magdalene, the other Mary, to see the sepulcher. In the end of the Sabbath, it should be translated literally, now late on the Sabbath, as it was getting dusk toward the first day of the week. The Sabbath doesn't end at dawn, but it ends at dusk. So that makes perfect sense. At dusk. And that's when they came. They waited till sundown and they came to see the sepulcher. John chapter 1, verse 33. And this one has caused churchianity to really go off the mark when it comes to immersing or baptizing, as the Bible commands to do. John 1, verse 31. And he knew him not, but that he should be made manifest to Israel. Therefore I am come baptizing with water. That leaves open all sorts of possibilities, doesn't it? Sprinkle, pour, squirt him with a squirt gun. No, not just being facetious. But that's not the meaning of water here. What it means is baptize in water, because that's what the Greek means. Baptizo, to whelm, overwhelm with water, to go underwater as a burial. And that's what it means. It's a burial. Sprinkling or pouring is not a burial. I've never seen anybody, you know, put in the grave and then somebody comes and sprinkles dirt on his head or whatever and said he's buried. But that's how they do it today when they baptize. It's not the fulfillment of baptism. John chapter 1, verse 17, well, 33 is another one. I knew him not, but he that sent me to baptize with water, and again, that should be in water. John chapter 1, verse 17, missed that one. For the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Yahshua the Messiah. It's a bad prepositional use there. Should be through. Through. Well, the law was given through Moses. It wasn't Moses' law, even though it came in some places to be called Moses' law, because basically he was the one, the transmitter. You know, he was the messenger. But really, the law came through him, not by him, as if it were his. Just a little nuance there that... You know, these things can cause problems. John chapter 13. I'm in 12. And supper being ended, the devil, having now put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him. Supper being ended. It should be and during supper. Revised Standard says that, rather than in supper being ended. Companion Bible note, the Last Supper recorded, it says, being ended in view of verse 26, Alfred's translation, supper having been served is preferable to the Authorized and Revised Version renderings. It means supper being laid, because then they have the washing, and you don't wash prior, you wash prior to eating, not after, so... There again, watch the translation. 1 Corinthians 1:18. 1 Corinthians 1:18. Each of these things can lead to doctrinal problems and has led to those things in the past. And so we need to be vigilant. It says, for the preaching of the stake is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved, it is the power of Elohim. Now, I thought the Bible says you're not saved until the end. How does that fit? Because Hebrews talks about that. If you understand the truth and then you reject it, there's no more sacrifice for your sin. You can't sacrifice Yahshua all over again. Once you totally reject it, That's it. It's done. And he says here, 18, which are saved, and really what that should be are being saved. If you look at the verb, that's really what it means. Those that are being saved are in the process of being saved. Likewise, 2 Thessalonians 2:10 should be are perishing rather than perish. The finality is the issue here. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 4. So many in the New Testament that we got to be careful of. This is one, if you're talking to your Christian friend next door, and he firmly believes that his name is Jesus, you can turn to Hebrews 4:8. And it says, "For if Jesus had given them rest, then he would not afterward have spoken of another day." What is it talking about? It's talking about Joshua, son of Nun of the Old Testament. You can find the same thing in Acts chapter 7 and verse 45. It says Jesus, it doesn't make any sense. Acts 7:45 is the companion to this one. I should say companion in error, which also our fathers that came after brought in with Jesus into the possession of the Gentiles. They came into the promised land with Jesus. No, it's Joshua, Yahshua. But you see, that makes the link. That links Yahshua's name with Jesus, which they say, you know, how can you prove it? That shows right there. A translator error proves Yahshua's name because it's the same as the Old Testament Joshua, which of course we know should be Yahshua because there was no J back then and for other reasons. Anyway, Hebrews 4:9 is another one. Oh, you can't find the Sabbath, the New Testament people say. There remained therefore a rest to the people of Elohim. And if the translators had done it right, you would be able to find Sabbath in there because that word, rest, is not rest in the Greek. It's a rest day. Sabbatismos. There remains therefore a Sabbath, rest, to the people of Elohim. So we find the Sabbath in the New Testament. It's right there. It's in the translation, and the translators did a disservice by not putting it right. 1 John chapter 5, verse 7. And here's another one with the Trinity doctrine. "For there are three that bear record in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Holy Spirit, and these three are one. And there are three that bear witness in earth, the Spirit, the water, and the blood, and these three agree in one." Where does that come from? Because it's not in the Greek. Where does it come from? Well, scholars say this came from the Vulgate, the Latin version. But it's not in the original. It wasn't in any version, really, until the 4th century, when the Trinity became a teaching. The NIV says the edition, the notes there, says the edition is not found in any Greek manuscript or New Testament translation prior to the 16th century. Jerusalem Bible says not in any Greek manuscript or the Vulgate. So there again, there's a discrepancy even there. What it should say, and this is how I've done it in my Bible, I put a bracket around the phrase that should not be in there. It should say, "For there are three that bear record, the Spirit, the water," and we're jumping down now to verse 8, "the Spirit and the water and the blood, and these three agree in one." That phrase from in heaven all the way down to in earth is not there. It should not be there. The New English Bible omits it. So there is a text, a proof text some use to show the Trinitarian doctrine, which simply isn't in the text itself. If you have a companion Bible like I do, and a lot of the other King James Bibles, you'll find that there's italics scattered throughout. And these italics were attempts by translators to explain something, you know, to add a word, to help word or something to make it more clear. Sometimes They only made it worse. So you can't, no language can be translated word for word directly into another language. We were down in Eldon, and there's a little development down there, and I've forgotten the phrase, but it's on one of the little buildings as you come in, and it talks about friendship. It's in German, and it ends with Gemütlichkeit. Gemütlichkeit is a German word that we can't really translate into English. We don't have a direct English translation. It means kind of a warm, fuzzy feeling of fellowship and friendship. And that's what that word means. We have no one word that fits it perfectly. A lot of languages are like that. You cannot find a perfect fit in another language. So the translators, they had to add words so that we would, you know, have a better understanding. Beginning in the year 1560, with the Geneva Bible, translators initiated the practice of italicizing, clarifying words to make the original language more plain. The 54 King James translators did the same. They took up the same thing. But often, they don't help make the meaning clear. Sometimes they do. Other times, through their doctrinal misunderstandings, it causes problems. Let's turn to Psalm chapter 81. Psalm 81, verse 4. For this was a statute for Israel and a law of the Elohim of Jacob. Was, you see, is added. Putting it in the past tense is something that's over and done with, you see. Actually, that doesn't exist in there. The verb is not there. This, a statute for Israel. Now we find that this is something more current. It's a statute for Israel, not something that's gone as something that's past tense. Over in Revelation chapter 20 and verse 10, we have another italicized effort here that doesn't really help us any. The devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet italicized are and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. Really, the verb there should be were, because they've already been destroyed in that lake of fire. The beast and the false prophet are human beings that are going to be destroyed when Yahweh throws them into that destructive burning fire. And it should have been were cast. Another instance, John chapter 8, 28. And this is interesting, because here is Yahweh's name. Look at this. John 8, 28. And they understood, verse 27, that he spake of them of the Father. Then said Yahshua unto them, when you have lifted up the Son of Man, then shall you know that I am he, and that I do nothing of myself, but as my Father has taught me, I speak these things. The word he has been put in there. That shouldn't be there. See, in the Hebrew, you'd read, for you'll know that I, Haya. That's Yahweh's name. Who will be what he will be, become what he shall become. The verb of very verb of existence, I am. That's what Yahweh's name means, that I do nothing of myself, but as my Father has taught me, I speak these things. You see how much closer we can get? We understand that he is the Father's Son, sharing the same surname of I am. And the translators throw it off by adding, I am he. If you understand the Hebrew language behind it, then it makes a lot more sense and a lot clearer. In Luke chapter 3, we find the words the Son are not in the original language. Luke chapter 3 and verse 23. And Yahshua himself began to be about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, which was the son of Heli. That's not in the original. Actually, Luke gives the fleshly descent of the Savior through Miriam, while Matthew gives the legal descent through Joseph. So they even kind of botched that one up pretty bad. Matthew 24, verse 24, all of it prophecy. Matthew 24. Let's look at verse 24. For there shall arise false messiahs and false prophets. Did you see in the news this last week or so where this moon, remember, quote, Reverend Moon, the Mooney, invited a bunch of senators and whatever to come to was it the Dirksen Senate Office Building? And they supposedly brought him in on a ruse. They were going to have some kind of presentation. And Moon stands up and starts to speak to them. He's the one that owns the Washington Times, by the way, which many appraise. It is a conservative newspaper, but see how he's edged his way in? He calls himself the Messiah. He says the Messiah to come. And the thousands of people follow him. Well, here he is now working his way into politics. The Bible says there shall be false prophets, false messiahs coming, saying, I am he, and shall show great signs and wonders, inasmuch as if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. Okay? Matthew 24, 24. Notice, and I want to... Inasmuch that if possible, they shall deceive the very elect. Those two words, it were, in the subjunctive case, kind of places it as if it can't happen. But if you read it as it should, inasmuch that if possible, they shall deceive the very elect. You see? It's more possible now, isn't it? It's as if they're going around to every person and trying to get them to be deceived. Kind of a thing. If it were possible, that person's not, but maybe this one is, you see. But when you say if it were possible, well, it can't be possible. But if it were, it would deceive them. You see how they messed that up when they added it were? Shouldn't be there. Romans chapter 1, verse 7. Chapter 1, verse 7 has the italicized words to be in it. This is not a real big issue, but just to show another way. To all that be in Jerusalem, beloved of Elohim, called, it says, to be saints. Actually, it should be called saints. Grace to you and peace. He's writing to the Romans, you see. And saints, the Catholic Church notwithstanding their understanding of it, are those who are alive. Brethren who are alive, technically that's who they are. The saints, he writes, the saints in Jerusalem, the saints in Galatia, the saints, these are the brethren in these different areas. So they're not called to be, but they are called saints because they are called and they are saints. 1 Corinthians 7, 19. And this has a direct bearing on many doctrines that have been twisted. 1 Corinthians 7, 19. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing, but the keeping of the commandments of Elohim. Here we need some italicized words to explain it. It should say circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing, but the important thing is the keeping of the commandments of Elohim. Okay? So there they should have put some in. They failed to do so. Colossians 2, 16 and 17, the famous Colossians 2. Let's look there real quick. I'm bringing some of these out because those that have yet to be exposed to these things could be thrown by those who would have them misunderstand what the Scriptures are saying as far as certain things like obedience. 2:16 and 17 of Colossians. Let no man therefore judge you in meat or in drink or in the respect of an holy day or of the new moon or of the Sabbath. And there we find days. Italicized, which are a shadow of things to come, but the body of Messiah. Okay? This can be properly understood if the italicized word is in verse 17 is left out. but are a shadow of things to come, but the body of Messiah. What does that tell us? Let no man judge you, but the body of Messiah. Oh, okay. That makes sense. These are the people that understand Yahweh's word. Let them judge you in meats or drinks or holy days or new moons. Not anybody, you see. That's how they say, well, those things are all done away. Because he says, don't let anybody judge you about that. I don't have to do it. Nobody has to judge me about it. Closed case, closed book. I'm going home. Let the body of Messiah judge you. And that makes perfect sense. Don't let men, but the body of Messiah. 1 Timothy 3:11. A few more here. 1 Timothy 3:11. Even so must their wives be grave, not slanderers, sober, faithful in all things. There is an italics, which is not implied in the original. So must wives be grave, not slanderers, sober, faithful in all things, not just their wives. You see? Although this has to do with qualifications of a minister, it's speaking generally. You see? And that's obvious because if that's the standard, then it applies to everybody, really. But specifically, these are the standards by which a person has to be raised to in order to be in that position. But that's what everyone's goal should be. 2 Peter 2:5. This is a big one. And many have grappled over this. And here again, sometimes translations will help. Because the King James is not the pure translation, as none are. But sometimes other translations can bring it out. 2 Peter 2:5. And spared not the old world, but saved Noah the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the unrighteous. Interesting. This isn't the one I was thinking of, I'm sorry. But interesting. This should be the eighth preacher of righteousness. He wasn't the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, but he was the eighth preacher of righteousness in the delineation of Yahweh's chosen people, you see. And that's why he saved him and his family. A nuance that's missed. 1 John 2:23. 1 John 2:23. Whosoever denies the Son, the same has not the Father. But he that acknowledges the Son has the Father also. That's an italic. But he that acknowledges the Son has the Father also. This is an addition based upon a Latin text, not the Greek. Whosoever denies the Son, the same has not the Father. Okay? Doesn't change a make a big meaning change, but it does show sometimes even whole phrases can be added. Luke 23:43. Some people claim Yahshua went straight to heaven at his death. 23:43. And Yahshua said unto them, verily I say unto you, today shall you be with me in paradise. The King James says exactly that. He said unto him, verily I say unto you, today you shall be with me in paradise. The comma, which the Greek never had. The Hebrew doesn't have punctuation either. So it's up to the whim of the translator. But I say unto you today, shall you be with me in paradise? He would be with him in paradise, but not today, because he didn't go there today. Remember? He died, descended into the grave. Okay. Mark 16:9. And he had to be dead for 3 days, or we don't have a Savior. 16 verse 9. Now when Yahshua was risen, here we got another problem. Early the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast 7 demons. It doesn't say Yahshua was resurrected Sunday morning. There's a missing implied comma here. And here's one that should have been put in there, between risen and early. When he was risen, early the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene. You see, because he was gone by Sabbath sunset, remember? He was gone by that time. 3 days and 3 nights. He was put in the tomb, Sabbath, just before sunset, and was risen 3 days and three nights later, the same time. So, not only with the choice of English words, with punctuation, word order, and all those things, can you find a difference in meaning. But even, for instance, like in the institution of the Passover, Matthew 26, just a small thing, but, you know, it makes a difference here. 26, verse 27. What did he really mean? He took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, "Drink ye all of it." Or did he say something like this? Since the Greek here uses the plural form of the word all, the English translation should be something like, "Drink from it, all of you. Drink from it, all of you." Be a command that you are to observe it, you see. Not so much the emphasis on drink all of it, but all of you drink it. And that's, you know, I've just touched on, just the tip of the iceberg here. But these are some of the ones that have given people problems in the past and continue to. And certainly Yahweh's word is the same yesterday, today, and forever. We just have to understand what it was yesterday so we can understand it today and forever. And that's the issue we got to deal with when we come to studying the scriptures. They're alive. The scriptures, you can pick them up and start reading them, and they become alive. You can't put them down. It's a living book. And even though there are some errors in there, truth comes through, and you can feel it as you read them. And this is what Yahweh wants us to do, to study like the noble Bereans. Find out, you know, where you've got to make a fine line distinction and go back as close as you can to those other languages from which these were derived. The English translations were derived, and then we'll know. Well, at least we'll have a lot better understanding, and that's almost like an ongoing charge, I guess, to Yahweh's people to study, to prove, to dig it out, and don't just accept it, even if it might say a certain way in a certain translation. Check others. Check the Hebrew. Check the Greek. I believe someday we'll find a Greek original. May not be in my lifetime, but I believe it exists. I believe it existed at least at one time, and I do believe that when he says he'll turn the faith of the children back to the fathers, the churchianity is going to say, "Hey, you know what? This is a Hebraic book. We're going back to the fathers. This is the foundation of Yahweh's word, not in something found in Corinth or somewhere else in Greece, but in firmly in the Hebrew scriptures. Yahweh made his covenant with Israel. And this is the people and the truth we're grafted into. May Yahweh bless you.
If we can all rise, I'll call on Brother Rowe.